Ja.
And why are there Bernie bros and not Bernie hoes?
No, there are.
Did we talk about having edibles at my holiday party?
And that I always underestimated is that men really like breasts.
Do you think I'm a Karen?
Valentine's Day is like New Year's Eve with nuclear weapons.
What you just said was so slut-shaming. And I wanted to
see how it's slut-shaming.
Welcome back to the Femsplainers and to 2022. I'm Danielle Crittenden, and I hope everyone had a wonderful, safe, and healthy holiday. It's a new year. We're looking at new adventures, and I wanted to give you all a heads up that I'm going to go on a new adventure myself. After more than 150 podcasts over nearly 4 years, I'm going to step back from the Femsplainers bar, pay my tab, and ride out of here. But I hope not into the sunset. Not yet. Nonetheless, it's been an extraordinary time to be doing a podcast. My original co-splainer, Christina Hoff Summers, and I started the Femsplainers in May 2018. In the wake of, and really as a response to, the wave of Me Too that was happening at the time. And since then, we've tackled women's issues, big and small, political and cultural. We've gone through a pandemic together. And we've had the privilege of hosting extraordinary women guests, and also many fascinating and fantastic mansplainers along the way. And for our final episode next week, Christina will rejoin me with a glass of wine, and we'll reminisce about some of our favorite moments, guests, and episodes, and I'll discuss or reveal some of my future plans. This week, I'm looking forward to hosting a truly remarkable woman. Her name is LaDoris Cordell, Judge Cordell, who has just published a book called Her Honor, My Life on the Bench, What Works, What's Broken, and How to Change It. Now, you may have seen Judge Cordell giving legal commentary on cable news or listen to her on NPR. A graduate of Stanford Law School, she became the first African-American woman jurist in Northern California in 1982. And in the decades since, she has presided over almost every type of case in court you can imagine. From family disputes in family court to arguing couples in divorce court to crazy stuff in municipal court and even to mental health court. And along the way, she's collected some pretty amazing stories about what she's seen. And in her new book, she's written a very lively and honest account of viewing and judging the full gamut of human nature that has been paraded past her. I met Judge Cordell when she was still writing her book. She lives just outside of San Jose, California, where I contacted her when I was researching a story in another project I was looking into at the time. Basically, I'd become fascinated with the case of Brock Turner. He was, as many of you will remember, the Stanford swimmer who was accused of sexually assaulting Chanel Miller in 2015, behind a dumpster on the Ivy League campus. And as in so many campus sexual assault cases we've discussed on this show, nothing appeared as it seemed, including the public understanding of the facts and what actually happened. Well, in any case, Brock Turner's subsequent trial drew worldwide attention. Brock was portrayed as the epitome of white male privilege, the heartless drunken frat boy, and his case pretty much foreshadowed the Me Too movement. Not long afterward, then-candidate Trump would boast about grabbing pussy, and Harvey Weinstein would be toppled from his movie empire. And it was in this atmosphere, the Santa Clara County Superior Court judge presiding over the Turner trial, Aaron Persky, faced a public recall. He had handed down what was seen as a light sentence for Turner, 6 months in prison for the sexual assault and attempted rape of then 22-year-old Chanel Miller. And while the California Commission on Judicial Performance found no wrongdoing in their investigation of the case, Persky was recalled in the 2018 elections. And in addition, he lost his pension and he had to pay Chanel Miller's $160,000 legal costs. And to the many judges and lawyers who supported him in an open letter, that set a disturbing legal precedent. Judge Cordell was one of those who supported Persky against the recall. And when I met her in her house to ask her why did she support him, she surprised and impressed me with her candor. A proud feminist and a self-described liberal activist judge, She nonetheless was troubled by what happens when public opinion campaigns and not the rule of law interferes with a judge's ability to rule fairly. So we'll talk a little bit about that case, but mostly I think you'll enjoy listening to Judge Cordell's insider tales of what it's really like to be presiding over and judging so many people's intimate lives and destinies. So I'll bring on Judge Cordell right after this message from one of our sponsors. Have you ever been listening to a podcast and wish that you could get a little more out of the experience? Well, Vodacast is the new exciting app that provides podcast listeners deeper digital stories with interactive podcasts. So let's say you're listening to a podcast about a crime. And if you're listening on the Vodacast app, you can see CCTV video footage of the suspect. Or if it references an article and you're listening on the Vodacast app, you can click on the link to check out the article. Podcasts come alive with images and links paired with audio. Download the app and go to the top of the Discover page to listen to and see podcasts with deeper digital stories. With Vodacast, you're not just listening, you're experiencing. Available in the App Store.
Hey guys, it's Brooke.
And Danielle from Gals on the Go podcast. It's very a minimal change, but basically what
Wait,
I did...
Can we talk about the TikTok? Because I saw you deleted it and I need to know that. I wasn't going to bring it up, but now that you're bringing it up. On our show, we talk about everything from college, lifestyle, to navigating your 20s and beyond. And there's always that quote that people say, like, if they like you, you'll know. If they don't, you'll be confused. But some people I don't know.
We hope you guys will join us every Wednesday for brand new episodes right here on Podcast One.
Welcome to the Femsplainers, Judge Cordell.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here and to have a conversation.
Well, reading your book, I thought of a joke a friend of mine, actually it's a real anecdote, a longtime friend of ours. His dad was a police officer in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, back in like the 70s and 80s. And he would get at night calls to their, you know, duty desk or whatever it is, from all kinds of crazy people. You know, they were seeing UFOs, they were having messages channeled into their brain. The things that is now you read on Facebook, they would come in calls to both newsrooms and police departments. And he'd listen to them and you go, yeah. And then the crazy person would say, wait, you don't believe me, do you? You're not, you don't really believe that I'm getting these messages from outer space. And he goes, no, I know, I do, but what am I going to do about it? You know, these crazy liberal judges. that they would always go, oh yeah, right. And then that would end the conversation. And you write about being labeled a liberal activist judge. But what I took away from your book is that you have this, how do I say it? Solomonic responsibility to rule on the most messiest, complicated situations of all aspects of life. And you covered them. You were in municipal court, family court, probate court, divorce court, eventually on superior court. And you can tell from your writing, such a wonderful, interested perspective to virtually every case that came up before you.
Yeah, it was important to me in writing this book that people get a sense about what it's like to be a trial court judge. Trial court judges are on the front line. We're what I call the people's court. The first judges anybody coming into court see are trial court judges. And as you noted, we preside over every aspect of human life. And the drama that happens in the trial courts, you can't make up this stuff. You just can't. So I wrote this book partly as a primer, as you noted, you know, just to get people aware of our legal system, how it works or doesn't work. And then I also wrote it as a memoir because that primer is informed by my own experiences. And I think that people appreciate it when readers can understand what was the judge thinking? And how do you deal with people who are just coming from who knows where and bringing all of their issues into a courtroom before a stranger in a black robe and asking that stranger to solve their problems? I mean, that's really what happens in the trial court. That job, it was the worst of jobs and the best of jobs, all in one. I had terrible days, I had wonderful days, and everything in between.
Yeah. Well, let's go through some of the decisions and cases you had to make. I think people will really identify with them. And so you had to deal with a lot of, juvie court, do we call it? A lot of juveniles. And those just seem to be nonstop, relentlessly heartbreaking stories. And you use a couple of anecdotes or cases about some of these 12, 13-year-olds find themselves charged with homicide. Talk about some of those cases and your takeaway from your experience on juvenile.
Sure. Juvenile court, people should understand there's two parts to it. One is the delinquency side, where juveniles are charged with crimes. And then there's the dependency side, where children have been abused or neglected and judges are responsible for putting them in foster care or whatever, just to get them out of the situation. In this book, I address the delinquency side. And I talk about two cases, one where a boy who was 15 killed his brother. He stabbed his brother, who was 17, and they were involved in an argument and a fight. And then the second case I talk about is a 15-year-old girl who I convicted of felony murder. And when I say I convicted, in juvenile courts, generally there are no juries. So the judge hears all the facts, the judge applies the evidence, and the judge makes the decision and comes up with a verdict. And I also write in the book that I think that juveniles charged with serious crimes, with felonies, should have the right to have a jury trial. But that's not the case. And the irony is, if you take an 18-year-old who has been charged with armed robbery, that 18-year-old has a right under the U.S. Constitution, the Sixth Amendment, to a jury trial. Take a 17-year-old or 16-year-old, same background, charged with the identical crime, tried in juvenile court, that child does not have a right to a jury trial. So you have identical crimes and you have a year or two separating them. And I don't think that that's fair. And I don't believe that judges can do the job that juries do. I don't believe we do it better or even as well. So as part of a teaser, I won't say exactly how I ruled in the case where the one brother stabbed the other and killed his brother. The issue in that case was, what do you do with a 15-year-old who is remorseful and feeling all the guilt having stabbed his brother? And again, they were in an altercation. And then the other case was convicting this young woman of a murder that she didn't know was going to happen, wasn't there when it happened, had no idea, and yet I found her guilty of murder under the felony murder rule. So in the book, I talk about why I think the felony murder rule should be abolished everywhere, because that child was not a murderer, yet to this day, and this has been many years now, she's a murderer in the eyes of the law.
Right. And I think what was impressive is your candor about, like, you know, obviously the law, but the law doesn't offer a lot of good alternatives in these more nuanced cases. And I remember in that story that you told about the brother stabbing the other brother, I mean, that the brother who got stabbed and unfortunately died, he was attacking the mother. He was a chronic abuser of his mother and brother. And the stabbing occurred when the brother was both attacking his mother and the brother ended up stabbing him. So it's so complicated. And then you're looking, as you write, about these 13, 14-year-olds, and what are you going to do with them? Do you throw them? The choices for juveniles is not great. So what, right. And again, it all comes up to you. Their entire fate is in their hands, your hands.
Yeah, absolutely. And juvenile courts originally started out as courts that didn't look at punishment. It was more rehabilitation, saying this is a child, someone whose mind is not fully developed and not mature. So we believe in redemption. And that's how the juvenile court started, why they were different from adult courts. And over the years, that attitude has changed, where it's looked at more as punishment. Many, many more juveniles are being tried as adults. And basically, that's the message saying, we've given up hope on you. We don't believe you can be redeemed. We're going to put you in the adult system. There is now an awakening going on as a result of Black Lives Matter movement that has really accelerated, that says we need to look again and think hard about juvenile courts. And the options are not great. So I write in when I had to decide, what am I going to do with this 15-year-old who I've now labeled a murderer? What am I going to do with her? I mean, part of it is the victims are saying, punish this person. I mean, this young man is dead, and this young woman with these other folks were involved in his killing. And so that, again, another teaser, is something I wrestled with to figure out, what am I going to do with this person who the system has labeled a murderer?
Well, I found also in your approach into many of the cases you wrote about, there was something special about you being Black and a woman. If this isn't like, I don't want to categorize and say that brings an altogether different perspective, but and you were also a mother. And so you, when in that case of that girl, again, without spoiler alert, you realize you just, at the end of this trial, you knew nothing about her. And you, I think it was you then commissioned a better psychological analysis. So you can, and then you find out about this girl's terrible life and, you know, what she'd been through. And it was that compassion and need to understand or have a better picture of this person that, you know, gave you insight into what would be an appropriate punishment. But as you point out, without a jury, these are things that most, not all judges would do that. You right. know, they would not right. be moms looking at this
That's
person
right.
as a kid, as well as a daughter, yeah. someone's daughter, as well as.
Yeah. So, I mean, you bring up two big points. One is that you're emphasizing the responsibility that trial court judges have. I mean, it's huge what it is we can do, what it is we should do. And the other issue you bring up is having diversity, representational diversity in our trial courts, meaning people of color and women, people with disabilities. Everyone should be represented in the judiciary. And that's not really what our trial courts look like. The judiciary does not really look like, is not as representational as it should be. And a lot of that has to do with how judges get appointed or elected. Frequently, it is governors. And if it's a conservative governor, they're not going to put a lot of people of color or women on the bench. If they're very liberal governors, they tend to do that. That's what's happened in California under a liberal Democratic governor. And I was lucky when I came along, it was Jerry Brown who was the governor. We're talking in the early 1980s, his first go round. And he revolutionized the judiciary in California by appointing women, members of the LGBTQ community, disabled people, people of color. So, and that's so important, as you just noted, about informing the perspective about how we look at people and then what it is we should do and how we should rule.
Just before I ask you about the next section of cases, just tell our listeners how many firsts you were. And I was shocked, like you were the first Black judge, female judge, and it happened quite late. I mean, I was sort of surprised that this had not happened before in California.
Yeah. So we're talking 1982 when I was first appointed to the bench by Jerry Brown. I was the first African-American woman judge in all of Northern California. Yeah. Before me, there had never been any. And that was 1982. It is kind of stunning when you think about it. And then as I moved in my career, I was the first African-American woman, again, in Northern California to move up. I was initially appointed to a lower trial court, and then I ran and was elected to the next level up, a superior court. Again, another first. Today in California, those two trial courts have been merged. So there's only one, just a superior court now. So a lot of, you know, this is, you know, when you're the first, there are all these stereotypes and all these biases just waiting for you, just sitting there waiting, waiting for you to fail, waiting for you to not step up. And that's people who don't want you to succeed. And a lot of times those were very conservative prosecutors who immediately stereotyped me as, well, she's Black, she's female, she's going to, you know, just be soft on crime, let all these people out. That's mm-hmm. not true. And then on the other side, there's the community of women and people of color who are saying, don't mess up, please don't mess up, because if you mess up, there aren't going to be any of us appointed and sitting up there. So the pressures were immense. I write about that in the book. And quite frankly, when I started, I didn't even know what I was doing. I mean, I'd been a litigator. Right.
You were so honest about that. Like, you're sort of thinking, like, so much of this is just my gut. After I understand the law, like, what I'm going to do here is.
Yeah. But, you know, that's kind of crazy, Danielle, because if you think about it, if you go into the medical profession, you're trained, And if you want to have a specialty, you do your residency and you have people guiding you. That's not what it's like being a trial court judge. So you have to be a lawyer for at least 10 years, but that doesn't mean you have to be in a courtroom. You could be a contracts person who does transactions and decides one day, oh, I'm going to be a judge. So you either get appointed or you run. And all of a sudden, here you are presiding in family court, deciding if the mom or the dad gets the kids. And that has nothing to do with anything you've done. And there's no requirement that you have that kind of experience before sitting up and deciding what happens to people's lives.
Right. It's like you were a dermatologist and now, oh, can you do some heart surgery this afternoon?
Exactly. Crazy.
You imparted this working in your with your juveniles. You did say the one great thing about being a judge is you can enact change more easily than others. And one of the things you did was the creation of the supervised visitation program. I was so impressed by that. Can you just explain why you created that? What happened?
Sure. And just as a preamble, the job of a trial court judge is not to make the law. It is mm-hmm. to follow the law and to enforce it. But within that context, there's nothing that keeps judges from being creative to look and see, how do I make this legal system better? And you notice, I don't call this a justice system. We're not there yet. We're still trying to get to the justice part. So when people talk about a criminal justice system or a justice system, I don't call it that. It's a criminal legal system or generally our legal system. So what I did is that I prided myself on being an activist judge. And usually that has a very negative attribute to it. It's usually judges who go rogue. They don't care what the law is and they don't care what community wants. It doesn't matter. That's bad activism. I'm talking about the good activism, which is you as a judge, you have a sacred position here. Not many people have it. Use every waking minute to make that system better if you can. And so, I write about in the book when I was presiding in family court, and I'd say that usually it were dads, and I'd say, you know, you haven't seen your kid, and they came into court because they wanted to visit with their kids or have custody. And I said, well, you haven't seen your child, but I'll allow it if there's a supervised visit, because maybe the dad had drug problems or whatever. And then I'd say, that's my order, go to a supervised visit. And then they'd come back and say, well, how do I do that? I hadn't thought about it. And then I did and said, there's no way they can navigate a system, because how do they find a supervisor? So what I did was create a supervised.
So you mean there was no legal, like at that point, you'd say, have a supervised visit. And yep. Like, what does that mean? Have your brother yep. there watching it or?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they'd go off and, okay, supervised visit. Even the lawyers like, well, yeah, can you get a relative? And what? So they'd come back. And that's when I said, well, wait a minute. You know, we need to get this better. If I'm making these orders, there ought to be orders that can be fulfilled. So I created the supervised visitation program. Probably it was the first in California, maybe in the nation. And what I did was go to seniors at senior centers, community centers, who were wonderful people who just really didn't have that much to do, and said, would you like to be supervisors of these visits? We trained them, actually paid the seniors, and the visits were at community centers where it was safe. And we did role plays to train them. I was in some of the role plays where I was an obnoxious parent showing up late to get a kid. And how do you handle it? And it had then it just picked up quickly and became really a cottage industry and is now, you know, all around the country, proving the point that one person in a black robe, a trial court judge, can make a difference.
Yeah, no. And I love this idea of bringing in seniors, you know, they've done that pre-pandemic on daycare as well, that they've you suddenly realize you have these whole buildings full of seniors who just want to be around kids. Yeah, and things.
Resources. And exactly.
Resources. So family court divorce, and we've even done a program of this. There's this belief, and I don't think it's unfounded, that it is often hard for fathers to get custody or even a very fair hearing if some sort of charges are easily made about them, especially in this post Me Too era. You know, you can just say the father did one thing, you don't have to have evidence, and then he's denied custody. And I know you got petitioned at one point by the National Congress of Men over a decision. I'd love your perspective on this because you've been through all of this.
Sure. And this points up my experience, and it's not unique, points up how difficult it is to be a trial court judge in the family court system. So I will be the first to tell you that I believe over the years there have been this bias against dads, just kind of generally. You'd have moms come in, and the thing was that they're the mother, they should have the kids. And that, I think, has just been in the system just years and years. So by the time I'm on the bench, there was some of that, but there were more women who were coming onto the bench who were actually, it was women, I think, who started looking at this and saying, well, wait, no, we just can't make these kinds of assumptions and stereotype dads. And so what we end up with and what happened to me is when I make a decision, if I said primary custody is going to go to the mom. Let me go back. So judges, we can't be people who want approval because you can't be someone who wants to please everybody. If you do, you'll never make a good trial court judge. So any decision a judge makes is going to make somebody happy generally and somebody not happy. And that's the dilemma for a judge in the family court system, where you've looked at a case carefully and decided, I believe it's in the best interest. And by the way, that's the only standard that can apply. What is in the best interest of the children? And of course, who knows that? Someone in a black robe? Of course we don't. I have no idea if the decisions I made were really right or correct, but you do the best you can given the system that we have. And by the way, I talk in the book where I talk about, I don't think that custody of children should result in what it does now, which is a battle of the experts. Each side brings in somebody and I'm going to be the better parent. And it ends up being this big battle. I think there should be, when there is a real issue of custody, and it's really hard for a judge to decide because all things being equal, custody maybe should go to both. And maybe it's not going to work because the parents just hate each other. I believe that there should be actually a panel of people who come together, who work together to look at the situation, examine everything, and then collaboratively come up with a recommendation. But we don't have that now. Now it's a battle in the courtroom. So I say to people who come into our family courts, it's important that we have judges who are not angry because their divorces were messed up and they got in, had awful custody battles, because the import then is to take it out on people and take one side or another. And I think we have to very carefully vet our family court judges. I happen to believe that that assignment, and I handled every assignment, criminal, civil, everything you mentioned, was the assignment that had the most serious impact on the lives of people was family court. And it's one assignment, I think, that is not given as much attention as it should be by everybody in the system. So what can I say other than that it was the most difficult assignment I had? I tried to do the best that I could. And there were people who didn't like what I did and thought, oh, she gave custody to the mom. And by that, when we say give custody, what do we mean? We mean the child will primarily live with one and visit with the other. And that's kind of the standard. The other is co-parenting. There's joint custody. Kid lives with the one parent for 1 week and the other the next. And I write in the book where I don't think that's healthy for a child, quite frankly, where they're shifting back and forth. And I've seen it where it has worked sometimes, but that's not, you know, what, in my view, what I think is results in the best interest of children. Children need stability and they need a place to be and have access to both parents. If both parents are basically good people who are seeking only the best for their kids and not trying to get at each other because of that.
Right. And there's no juries in these cases, right? So again, it comes
except
down.
Except in Texas.
Yeah.
So you can request a jury in a custody battle in Texas.
But it does come down to these, as you say, sort of expert performance artists who, and in a bitter divorce, it's just wrenching because the goal is to slime the other parent the best you can. And then you're at the mercy of this one judge. As opposed, what would a panel look like? How would you form such a thing?
You know, I'd have child psychologists on it. I wouldn't have lawyers on it. Yeah. And I'd have who have been probably more those who are in the academic setting who have been child psychologists, say they're teaching at law schools. They get it. They understand the legal parts of this, but also the development of children, maybe interview parents. It's very, very tricky. But in the end, it's going to be up to the way our system works now. It's going to be up to a judge to make that decision. Although judges today get recommendations, right? I mean, the experts come in and do battle, and then the judge has to kind of figure it all out. And it just feels like Mission Impossible. That's what it felt like to me. Mm-hmm. And in the end, you just try to make your best call and try to, as best you can, understand what your biases are and get them out of the way. And that's a whole nother thing. I write about that in the book, about how bias is just all in there. We know, it's all talked about now. They're very explicit. You know, I don't like people who look a certain way versus the bias that we don't really know is there, but it all comes out in how we decide cases. And that's even harder. So it's complicated. And at the same time, this is the system we have. And until we can come up with some alternative that better addresses the interests of children, I'm not sure where we can go.
Have you ever thought that you'd prefer that your bank was less like a bank? Like all those hidden fees and fine print, difficult to use mobile apps, weeks to open an account, chatbots and automated phone quote unquote support, charge $3 per transfer and up to $25 for incoming wires, and charge $3 to use out-of-network ATMs. Well, small business owners, startups, freelancers, entrepreneurs, do you know what the number one way to avoid all of this is? Step one, close your account. Step two, open a new Novo free business account. Because Novo is the number one business banking app, because it's built from the ground up to be powerfully simple and free business banking that Money Magazine has called the best business checking account of 2021. With Novo, there are no minimum balances, no transaction limits, and no hidden fees. Sign up for free in under 10 minutes at banknovo.com/FEM, F-E-M, and then they'll mail you a Novo debit credit card, and you get free ATM use. Novo makes banking easy and secure. You can manage your account in Novo's customizable web, Android, and iOS apps, with built-in profit-first accounting and invoicing. Plus, you can tag each transaction and upload receipts. Novo's already changed business banking for over 100,000 small businesses. Money Magazine also calls it the best business bank account, and it won the Banker's Award for most innovative bank in North America. That's not least because Novo seamlessly integrates with most leading business tools and services like Stripe, Shopify, QuickBooks, and more for free. Plus, Novo offers over $5,000 in perks and discounts just for signing up. So get your free business banking account in just 10 minutes at banknovo.com/FEM, F-E-M. Go to banknovo.com/FEM to sign up for free right now and get a free copy of Novo's Small Business Starter Guide. That's banknovo.com/FEM.
The FEMsplainers is brought to you in part by Progressive. What's one thing you'd purchase with a little extra savings? A spa day? That pair of shoes you've been coveting? Well, Progressive wants to make sure you're getting what you want by helping you save money on car insurance. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive can save over $700 on average, and customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts when they sign up. Discounts like having multiple vehicles on your policy. Progressive offers outstanding coverage and award-winning claim service. Day or night, they have customer support 24/7, 365 days a year. When you need them most, they're at their best. A little off your rate each month goes a long way. Get a quote today at progressive.com and see why 4 out of 5 new auto customers recommend Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary, discounts vary, and are not available in all states and situations.
It's going to sound weird, but one of the most entertaining parts of your book was when you were on probate court and having to sort out, especially in California, competing interests in the wills. You had one of the most startling cases of who inherited a very large fortune.
Is this the cats?
The cats.
Yeah, this is the cats. And it's just, you know, part of being a trucker judge is, like I said, the drama, and it's so entertaining. I swear it is. So, a man, you know, an inventor, Stanford graduate, dies, and he has no surviving family members at all. And so he left his fortune, which was substantial, to 4 cats. And the thing is, they weren't like your cats that you keep in your house. They were feral cats.
They were feral. I didn't know that.
Feral cats. And the key was, he had a big trust for the cats, but he left. He said, I want the money to be used to provide for them in a way that makes them most comfortable. I forget what the exact language is. I wrote it in the book. And I was like, who would write this kind of language? What does that mean? So each of the cats had a lawyer. So that didn't help.
Did the cats have to appoint them? Did the cats interview the lawyers? How does that even work?
You know, you have the trustee of the whole trust who says, okay, well, you know, these are different cats. I got Tom, I got Mary, I got all these cats. And then we have also the beneficiaries. So all the money that didn't go to the cats, if the cats died out before the money went to all of these pet organizations like the SPCA. So all those lawyers showed up. So I had a courtroom full of lawyers all fighting over a dead person's stuff and competing with the cats.
And can you tell us the ending of that one? I mean, that was so because also you then noted these other cases, which I'd never heard of, that, like, of course, Leona Helmsley famously left millions to her little dog. And then there was some countess somewhere who left $100 million fortune to her dog. How do you rule on that? Like, who gets to spend the money? It just seems to me you're setting up a great position for theft of whoever the trustee is.
Well, that was happening, before I got involved in it. And it's very common to have these pet trusts, wealthy people who set up these trusts so that when they're gone, you know, their pets are cared for because they love their pets. And that's fine. The issue is, you know, how does that care get given, and how does the money get distributed? So how did the case end? It ended, thank God, I didn't have to make a decision because I pushed settlement really hard. You all need to sit down and work out a settlement. And there were, you know, accusations the trustee was taking too much money, and there was a woman who was appointed to take care of somebody. It was crazy, but they ended up settling the case. So
so funny. All right. Then you oversaw adoption. Now this, I'm really, really interested in this because aside from you had many interesting things to say on interracial adoption, which I'd like you to talk about. But then were you there with what is going to be interesting to me is when you start having issues of surrogacy, of gay parents where one is not, you know, there is a biological father or mother somewhere, but what happens if they decide they want to claim rights? Did those issues ever come into your court?
Well, I did. I know in our county, the first same-sex adoption. So back in the day, let's just talk about two women, they've been together a long time. One of them goes to a sperm bank, she's pregnant, has the kid. And it used to be then that her partner had to do a step-parent adoption. mm-hmm. the kid. So you have those instances. I never had, and that's changed now. You don't have to go through the step parent. They can get married and then they have a kid.
Right.
But I did not have a case where there was a same-sex adoption and then there was a dad. Let's say they didn't go to a sperm bank, they go to a dad. And I did not have a case, although those cases have come up really big. And in fact, HBO, I think, just recently released a documentary called Nuclear Family. And if ever, you haven't seen it.
Oh, yes, I've heard about this. Yes.
That's really something to watch. And that's where everything just exploded. And again, the courts. Here we go, trial court judge. And then the appellate courts got involved in that. And that happened all out in San Francisco. But adoption cases in general were a win-win for everybody. I mean, a judge gets to put a family together. They walk out, everybody's happy. But the one case I write about was one that was just tragic where I had to set aside an adoption. So you have a child who was abandoned initially, ends up with an adoptive mother, and then things went sour and I had to set aside the adoption. So she's abandoned again. I write about it in the book and write that this is where the system royally failed this child. And it wasn't the fault of the adoptive mother at all. It was a systemic flaw and I called it out in the book. And I hope that has never happened to any other child.
And this sort of raises interracial adoption, Native American adoption. I don't want to call it a fashion, but that's what it became in the 70s and 80s for white parents to adopt from Indian reservations. The thinking now that you hear from certain activists is that you should never mix races. And I was really interested in your opinion on that because you were flying against that.
Yeah. And I do write about that in the book because back in the day, there was an organization, a national one of Black social workers who were advocating that Black children should only be placed with Black families to maintain the culture. And that if they could not be placed with Black families, they should just stay in foster care. And I write about it and I write that was just, to me, untenable. That's not putting the best interests of children first, to leave a child without a family, without an anchor at all, rather than put the child with a family that's not culturally the same. So I'm clear on where I stand on all of that. And it is a priority with me, if there's a Black child and there's a Black family and there's a white family, I would lean toward the child being with a Black family to maintain the culture. But that doesn't mean exclusively, but I would tend to favor that. At the same time, if there were no family of color for a child of color, and there was a family who was white that could provide a good home, of course, I would be happy, absolutely happy to preside over such an adoption.
Mm-hmm. You had to deal with mental health court. Fun fact, Judge Cordell, I don't think you know this about me. About some years ago, I was pushed at a subway train by a schizophrenic. This was in Toronto at the time. There was a rash of these going on. A woman had been killed a couple months previous. And I had been walking along a subway platform and this small mouse-like, librarian-like woman was passing me and I stepped out of her way. And just as the train was picking up speed, leaving the station, she body checked me. And fortunately, because she was small, I ended up spinning around, but I did not hit the train. And anyway, being Toronto and other people knowing I was just visiting at that time, I had no idea this had been a rash. Anyway, we tracked her down. Some men sort of tackled her, got her to the police. Turns out she's a schizophrenic. Turns out she's gone off her meds. And I worked with the prosecution, the Crown Attorney, as it is in Ontario. And I said, you know, look, this is dangerous. This is happening a lot. I was lucky. I'm willing to do whatever you think we need to do to make sure that this person isn't out walking around, not taking her meds and threatening people. And they ended up getting a plea bargain. And the father said that he would make sure that his adult daughter would take her meds. And honestly, nothing was ever really done about it. And you write about this is a big problem we have throughout, that we're looking now at homeless people on the streets, schizophrenics, people who should be getting mental health are not. They can be a danger to the public. And you had to deal. I'd love to hear your views on this, both public safety and also dealing humanely.
Yeah. I'm so sorry you had that experience. And that just.
Well, I'm a reporter, so that I wasn't hurt. Yeah. I just found it interesting, honestly.
Oh, my God. So I have a chapter in the book called It's All in Your Head. And if you read it, it gives a history about mental health and how it has been dealt with in the courts from back in the day to where we are today, where it's such a serious problem, as you've mentioned, that we have courts specially set up just to deal with people who have mental health issues. Now, before that, people with mental health issues were thrown into the criminal system, the criminal legal system, and basically locked up, punished. It doesn't really address the problem. So that's when this idea of having mental health courts came up. We need to address the problem. People are not taking their meds. How do we do it? But there was also the background to this, where people were, for a time, if they were off their meds, they were in psychiatric units and they were locked. And then we have Ronald Reagan come along, the whole issue of let's shut these down. And basically people were just out on the streets and right. We're not going to force this on people. So we end up now with, the homeless issue, and majority of people who are homeless are suffering from mental illness. It's a huge problem. And so part of the solution has been to look to the courts to deal with those folks who are come into the system through the criminal system and then get diverted into the mental health courts. So when I was on the bench, and it is true of judges who preside over these courts, our job is to preside over hearings where people are in locked psychiatric units. They want to go home. They want to get out, and home may be on the streets, but they want out. And the docs are saying, no, you shouldn't be out. You're not med compliant. They have a right to come before a judge, a trial court judge, for a hearing. And the issue I bring up in the chapter is, so what training do trial court judges have to preside over cases and decide whether or not a person who is in a locked psychiatric unit should be out? What training? And the answer is none. You learn it on the job, and the lawyers kind of educate you as you're presiding over cases, which is totally unacceptable. And I'm one of those. I had to learn on the job. And I write, of course, in the book about the very first case I had. I didn't know what I was doing. It was a very serious issue that was before me. So one of the things I did was to learn as much as I could about this on my own, about the DSM, which is now the DSM-5, and understanding that that's the Bible that has all of the definitions of mental illnesses. And that has to be something judges have to know about if they're going to preside and listen to testimony from psychiatrists and from people who want to get out. So a lot needs to be done in this area. And the vision is that the courts are part of the solution. And I know some judges who devote their legal careers when they're on the bench to just handling these cases because they care so much about these issues. Maybe someone in their own families have struggled with mental illness, and they are doing their best to be creative, to come up with ways to see that people who are in need of help get that help. And then the courts are there to kind of enforce it, to ensure that people take their meds. But at some point, there's so much you can do.
Well, you live near San Francisco.
Yes.
We know what's happening there.
Yep.
What do you think when you look at that? Do you have any solution to, it's heartbreaking, but it's also terrifying and crazy that yep. the cities, and we've seen it in LA, that parts of cities have just gotten so out of control.
Absolutely. And I live near San Jose, California, and I've also recently was in Oakland. And in Oakland, I was driving down Martin Luther King Way, and it's a long boulevard. And I drove at least four long blocks, and I was astonished with the number of homeless people. And also, you could see so many were mentally ill because they were wandering in the middle of the streets. Mm-hmm. Oakland hasn't solved the problem. San Francisco hasn't solved the problem. San Jose hasn't solved the problem. I don't know what the answer is. We know that part of this is these places are very expensive places in which to live, but so many of these people are dealing with mental illness and they're not taking their meds. So question, do we need to change the laws? Do we need to say to people, we're going to go back to where we were. We're going to force you to take your meds. And if we have to be in a locked facility, that's what we're going to do. Should we do that? I don't know. We used to do that. And I think when we used to do that, maybe there wasn't the kind of homelessness that there is now. I don't know. I mean, I'm not one who has studied the matter seriously enough to really give you, Danielle, a good answer to that. I don't know. I'm just kind of at a loss on that. And as a judge, we do what we can do within the setting in the courtroom.
Right. No, as from my own experience, and I felt compassionate towards this woman. Mm. But it also seemed crazy to me that these people were just walking around without help. Yeah. Last thing I wanted to talk to you about is going back to judicial activism, the election of judges. You've been so profound on this. I'm originally Canadian. So this idea that as a judge, you have to run for office was very startling to me. And it opens up, as you write about, all kinds of issues of conflict of interest. You know, large corporations start to donate to you. Do they have an agenda for certain laws? So let's talk a little bit about that. And you had to wage a major campaign to get on the Superior Court.
Right. So there's a chapter in the book called Judges for Sale, because that's what's going on in our judiciary across the country. Judges are running in elections and people who want to be judges, and these have become political campaigns. The big problem with this is that judges are not politicians. They cannot be. So what's a politician? A politician is someone who says, vote for me, and I promise to do X, Y, and Z. That's fine. That's why they run. Judges cannot make promises other than to uphold the constitutions of their state and of the federal government. That's it. But that's not what's happening. Judges are kissing up to, and these are judicial candidates and also judges who want to retain their seats, kissing up to corporate interests, to business communities, to people who just have an interest in wanting judges to rule in their favor. And the problem with that is that it completely erodes the one principle that makes our judiciary special, and that is judicial independence. And by judicial independence, all I mean is that when I make a decision as a trial court judge or as an appellate court judge, I am not looking over my shoulder or putting my finger to the wind to find out how people are going to receive my decision. When we start doing that, there is no independence. The judicial independence means I look at what happens in my courtroom, I listen to the evidence, I know the law, I apply the law to the facts, and I come out with a decision. Anything other than that destroys judicial independence. There are three prongs to our democracy: executive, legislative, and judiciary. And if any one of those prongs gets pulled out, one of those legs gets removed, we don't have a democracy. My concern is today, with recalls of judges, with threats being made to judges, we are in serious danger of losing that judicial independence. And we lose that, we've lost our democracy.
Well, you were very instrumental and prominent during the recall of Judge Aaron Persky. Judge Persky presided over the Brock Turner trial at Stanford University. He was labeled famously the Stanford rapist. He was a Olympian directed swimmer, training for the Olympics as a swimmer on the Stanford swim team. He was found, and it was in the press, he was found raping a 22-year-old woman named Chanel Miller behind a dumpster. And then he went to court, and Aaron Persky ruled that he would have 6 months in prison, and this was deemed unsatisfactory. Of course, there was huge press on this case. And then people organized a recall campaign and successfully recalled Judge Persky. So what? And you knew Judge Persky, and you got into this unbelievable fight, especially within Palo Alto, where you both live, about the recall. So give me your perspective on that. And you know, why wasn't this such a, you know, why wasn't this a too lenient sentence he gave out? And why shouldn't he have been recalled?
So many people have gotten the facts wrong about this case, and I'm not going to go into it, but I will talk about what Judge Aaron Persky did. I became basically his voice, because at the time, judges are not were not allowed to defend themselves. So if you're a judge presiding and somebody is misconstruing what you've done and misrepresenting and just lying about your track record and your case, judges were not allowed to respond because the case was pending. And that meant there were surrogates. I became one of those surrogates and actually the leading voice to oppose the recall of Aaron Persky. And the reason why was all based upon judicial independence. Specifically, Aaron Persky sentenced this young man, no prior criminal history, and who was a freshman at Stanford, sentenced him to 6 months in jail following the recommendation of a female probation officer. And judges almost routinely follow the recommendations of the probation department. Probation interviews everybody, victim, defendant, friends, and then comes with a recommendation. Judges don't have to follow it, but he did. Not unusual. What he did was lawful. He stayed within the law and ordered a sentence that he believed was fair. It was a controversial sentence. People didn't like it. And that is why he was recalled. Not because he did anything wrong, not because he, oh, this is a lousy, terrible judge. In fact, he had been on the bench 13 years and has had a reputation as being one of the better judges in the court. So what we ended up with was a recall that was successful because a judge made a ruling in one case that some people didn't like. They organized and they used the recall provision, which is in the Constitution of California, that says you can recall any public official, including judges, for any reason at all, which I think is outrageous. And in fact, in the book, when I write about this, I identify two states that don't allow that. They allow judicial recalls, but only if the judge has engaged in malfeasance, has engaged in misconduct, or has committed a serious crime. If that's the case, the judge shouldn't be allowed to continue and fill out his or her term. The judge should be removed right away. But those states also say when a judge makes a decision that is lawful and within the judge's discretion, that may never be the basis for a recall. So I recommend that every state that allows judicial recalls, not all do, have that kind of a provision in it. So what we've done now with the removal of Aaron Persky is send a message to at least to judges in California and actually beyond. You make a decision that somebody doesn't like and somebody gets a bee in her bonnet, she can organize and then get rid of you. And that's it. So his legal career was over in the blink of an eye. Because
he lost
of one
his pension.
Lawful decision. He lost everything, and his reputation. So you Google his name and you will hear, you know, you'll see all these things and read all these things that are not true. But that's because we're in the age of social media. Word went fast. Things got misconstrued. And unfortunately, the media decided to join the party, to drink the Kool-Aid. And here's where we are. And I think it's very, very sad.
Well, and just to stress that in the case that Brock Turner had not raped the girl. His pants were on when he was caught or found. They were both blind drunk. I mean, they were both beyond any standard drunkenness. And as you say, he was a freshman. He had no prior record. He actually came from a very working class family, but he was made into this symbol of white male privilege, frat boy who just would wantonly take a girl behind a dumpster. And there was, you know, it was a very complicated case the minute you started looking into it. And it's not to defend him or what happened, but when you then look at Judge Persky's sentence in the context of that crime and then the time that he had spent and everything he lost, the other thing that that Persky did, which you and I have talked about, was he put Brock Turner on the
sex offender registration
for life. That's meaning right. He will never, ever be able to live within what, right. a mile of a school or in, right. And he will have this through his whole life.
Yeah. And what's interesting about all this and sad is that if you are convicted of murder, manslaughter, murder, and you serve your time in prison, 19 years, 20 years, and you're out and you're back in the community, you don't have to register as a murderer. No, you're off parole and you just go live your life. You could be in your own community. Those of your listeners here, there might be somebody in your community that's been convicted of murder. And so everybody's like, well, we believe in redemption. Person paid the price and now they're back. And yet for him, this young man, this freshman, and all of this attention, he gets labeled for the rest of his life. I find that patently unfair. And I think that the fact that he is labeled in this fashion is a violation of his Eighth Amendment right against cruel and unusual punishment. But that's the way the law is now. So I want people to think when they think, oh, you know, Danielle and Judge Cordell defending Brock Turner. No. What I'm saying is that if we believe in redeeming our young people, if we believe in redemption, if we believe that punishment is important, but redemption, why aren't we showing that in this particular case? And we certainly aren't doing it with him having this mandatory registration for the rest of his life.
Right. And the general problem of over-incarcerating people for, you know, crimes that where there has been like no history, there is no question that Brock Turner wasn't going to, you know, become some serial rapist. And just the idea of, and you've written about this too, overcrowding prisons or giving too harsh a sentence often falls upon minorities and particularly Blacks. So you're trying to set an example of not throwing the book in ways that don't fit the crime.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, then when something like this happens, the publicity drives the sentencing, or in this case, the recall.
Yeah. And again, I don't write in the book about defending this young man. I write in the book about Judge Persky, what he did. And I write quite frankly, if that case had come before me, I would have imposed the same sentence. I would have. And I think, and I've said this publicly many times, I think most judges, most reasonable judges would have done the same thing. So that's really my concern here, is about what happened to a judge who used his discretion, stayed within the law, and was punished for doing so.
Mm-hmm. Well, Judge Cordell, the sad thing is you've retired. Like, we've lost your, you look too young to have retired, and we've lost your voice on the bench. So how are you going to keep tackling these issues that you're obviously still very passionate about and that your book is very powerful about? I mean, you do list fixes and suggestions.
Right. So the book has a chapter called The Fix. And in it, I write about at least 10 things that I think can be done by every ordinary folks, those not even in the law, to make our legal system fairer. And so we can get to the point where we can call it a justice system. So I will continue to push forward and to work on those kinds of fixes and to speak out. And I want others to do that. I adopt, just let me just close out with this, you know, my mantra, what I use to kind of get me going each day to give me purpose, I take from Alice Walker. And she said, activism is my rent for living on this planet. So as long as I live on this planet, I want to keep paying my rent. And I encourage all of us, and you know, with your podcast, you're paying your rent for being on this planet. And I encourage all of us to do it. And one way to do it, read my book, Her Honor, and then think about the fixes I propose and the kinds of things that we might do to make the system work for everybody.
Well, that's very powerful. I hope you don't, I'm glad to hear you'll continue your activism in some form. And it's just been such a pleasure to have you and so interesting. Good luck with everything you do. And thank you for coming on the Femsplain.
Thank you so much. This is a wonderful podcast and I'm glad to be a part of it.
Thank you. When it comes to feminine health issues, we're often embarrassed or ashamed to talk about them. And especially the one I'm about to bring up, which if I'm guessing, if it was a male problem, men might even boast about it. I'm talking about odor from down there. Yes. Okay, I'll say it. Vaginal odor. Who are you going to call? Well, when Deanna Seymour Story, CEO and founder of women's wellness brand PhD Feminine Health, was working in the pharmaceuticals industry 6 years ago, she discovered no one. There was no one you could call except your doctor. And as she said, quote, during that time, I got so frustrated getting the same medications and having really disappointing results. I was in search of a holistic solution for vaginal issues, but it was imperative to me to find an ingredient that was backed by published clinical data. So Seymour started researching boric acid and came across dozens of studies that had been done on this ingredient, but no one was manufacturing it commercially. Thus, PhD was born. Boracic acid is a natural compound found in seawater and has been recommended by medical professionals for decades as a safe, holistic alternative. PhD is now the number one doctor-recommended brand of boric acid vaginal suppositories. When you have feminine issues, you want a solution immediately. PhD offers trustworthy feminine care products that actually work. Plus, you'll be supporting a female-owned and founded company. So these days, PhD believes that self-care is crucial to your overall well-being. Give the gift of self-care and love to yourself. Register now at phdfemininehealth.com/win to receive a free lifestyle subscription box from our friends at Bombay and Cedar, which contain vegan and cruelty-free deluxe size beauty and lifestyle products, a retail value of over $100, plus a $500 Visa gift card. So go to phdfemininehealth.com, phdfemininehealth.com/win, and you'll also get 20% off all products right now. Use code FEM, F-E-M. FEM to get 20% off at phdfemininehealth.com/win. Oh, I love Judge Cordell. She's so fantastic. Her book again is called Her Honor, My Life on the Bench, What Works, What's Broken, and How to Change It. And I'll look forward to having you all join us for our final episode of the Femsplainers next week, when I'll be joined by my original co-splainer, Christina Hoff Summers. Don't miss it. See you next week. Thanks for listening. The Femsplainers is a weekly podcast carried on the Podcast One Network. Matt Frum produces and edits our audio and video. You can follow us on Twitter and FB at Femsplainers and on Instagram at Femsplainers Podcast. We love hearing from you. You can reach out to us via email at contact@femsplainers.com. You'll find all our episodes and more information about me and the podcast at femsplainers.com. And remember, we rely on your donations to keep this podcast going. So please consider supporting us at patreon.com/femsplainers.